the scribbling just goes on and on.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Today, Roald and I will dig into some poetry, after which we'll get Garrison Keillor's poetic contribution with the Writer's Almanac on Scribble. Well, Roald, today we use our fierce old license as co-host of this program to do as we please.
Well, okay. I've got a lot of doing as I please here, too. I've got pages.
Pages and pages.
Pages, I mean, since you suggested that we ought to talk a little bit about poetry, and particularly, and this intrigues me, poetry that's sort of fallen by the wayside, that still I have a place in my heart for, and I know you do, too.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens, that poems catch you and stay with you, and the rest of the world lets it all go. It's just one of those things. And when you look back across the whole history of poetry, the Cavalier poets, does anybody read the Cavalier poets anymore?
No.
Yeah, I love them.
What they read in place of the Cavalier poets are the metaphysical poets.
Yeah, I could not love thee, dear, so much, loved I not honor more. I'll never forget those lines.
No, but you know, those are currently not sort of in the way real poetry is in. For me, it's Conrad Aiken.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just went through a period in college where I read everything I could get on He's a New England Poet. But are you familiar with the poem, Music I Heard With You Was More Than Music, and
yeah,
Bread I Broke With You Was More Than Bread? Now that I am without you, all is desolate. All that was once so beautiful is dead. I just love that poem. But, of course, it's not currently fashionable.
Well, who cares?
Well,
that's great stuff. You know, but that happens, though. When I think about the music I grew up with, I grew up knowing the music that my grandparents and my parents listened to, because it was all a big continuum. But then about the time after the Second World War, when society fell apart, you had the senior citizen enclave, the country club set, and the kids. And they were separate. And they had separate things. Kids, all of a sudden after the Second World War, had money. And money that was loose. That had never happened in the world before. And so all of a sudden the popular entertainments all catered to children's tastes. And all the past began to just drift away. And the continuity that we had, things would change, but they changed over decades of centuries, really. And now, all of a sudden, there's this great disconnect all the way along.
Well, one of the things that happened, at least this is my explanation, is that in about the mid-1930s, I'm not sure of the date, but literally almost overnight, the way in which we English teachers taught poetry changed inside out.
Why?
Because two teachers, Cleanth Brooks and Robert Penn Warren from Yale, wrote a book called Understanding Poetry. And they were coming at it from the position that has come to be known as the New Criticism, where you look closely at the text, you analyze it, you look for levels of meaning, you look for ambiguity, and you look for poems to be tight and hard and sort of laid back, classical. T.S. Eliot, I suppose his poetry contributed to this too. But for example, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow taught literature at Harvard. And there are records of him sitting in the Harvard yard surrounded by a class of students discussing Wordsworth. And his way of discussing a Wordsworth poem is to say, well, I've been to that mountain, I've been to that glade, I've been to the Wordsworth home, and talk a little bit about what Wordsworth was like and what the countryside was like and what it was like to hike the country. That is, to enhance the flavor of the poem. but never, apparently, would Longfellow A says, what's the purpose of line three?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Brooks and Warren, you know, if a poem doesn't have that level of ambiguity, that laid-backness, that hardness, that irony, much of it, then it can be dismissed. As a result of Brooks and my mother loved Psalm of Life by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and I loved it too when I was going to school before I got to college and learned not to like it, right? Because it doesn't hang together. It doesn't. From Brooks and Warren's point, Psalm of Life makes no sense at all. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time. Well, sand doesn't leave footprints very long, right? That's just ridiculous. And the end is, the last stanza is even more ridiculous. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. To wait? What the whole poem has been about. Words, you know. So if you examine that poem carefully, it just falls completely apart, as does Trees by Joyce Kilmer. Lifts her leafy arms to pray. Is that a girl with hairy arms? You know, what? So Brooks and Brooks and Warren and the New Criticism came in, and with it a kind of poetry that worked.
Yeah, and just drained the blood right out of it.
Well, no, it didn't. I mean, yeah, no, but it created a different kind of poetry. One of your favorite love poems is the result of the New Criticism, John Frederick Nim's love poem.
Yeah.
Compare that with Shelley's Indian Serenade. I arise from dreams of thee in the first sweet sleep of night. Lift me from the grass, I die, I faint, I fail. Let thy love and kisses rain upon my lips and forehead pale. You know, at that point, the kid in the background lets a big burp out, and it destroys the mood. But Nims anticipates the fact that there's going to be some resentment.
But Nims is, let me read it.
Today, that's a better poem. To my mother, that poem would have made no sense whatsoever. Read it, yeah.
Yeah. My clumsiest dear, whose hands shipwreck vases, at whose quick touch all glasses chip and ring, whose palms are bulls in china, burrs in linen, and have no cunning with any soft thing, except at all ill-at-ease fidgeting people, the refugee uncertain at the door you make at home. Deftly you steady the drunk clambering on his undulant floor. Unpredictable dear, the taxi driver's terror, shrinking from far headlights pale as a dime, yet leaping before red apoplectic streetcars, misfit in any space, and never on time. A wrench in clocks and the solar system, only with words and people and love you move at ease. In traffic of wit expertly maneuver and keep us all devotion at your knees. Forgetting your coffee spreading on our flannel, your lipstick grinning on our coat, so gaily in love's unbreakable heaven our souls on glory of spilt bourbon float. Be with me, darling, early and late. Smash glasses. I will study wry music for your sake. For should your hands drop white and empty, all the toys of the world would break. That's beautiful.
It's beautiful, but it's beautiful partly because of Brooks and Warren and their book.
How?
Because it's laid back. It doesn't come out and say, oh, I love you. I'll love you till the end of time. I'll do this. I'll do that. It does it. Here's an even more laid-back love poem. It doesn't even sound like a love poem, but I think it is. I use this in class a lot. William Carlos Williams, This Is Just to Say. Are you familiar with that poem?
No, I don't think so.
It's in the guise of a note left on the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox, which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me. They were delicious, so sweet and so cold.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why isn't that just a note on the refrigerator? Why is that a poem? The more you look at this, right, probably it sounds plum-like, probably. Icebox, rather than fridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
And is the relationship between this man and his wife, William Carlos Williams, was a pediatrician in Paterson, New Jersey, and it's unlikely that he had to go to the hospital early and left this note for his wife. And it's sort of teasing, just like the Nims poem is. Mm-hmm. But Elsa, you can look at all you're told there, all packed into that little note about the relationship between these two people, the husband and the wife.
There's a bit of criticism about William Shakespeare that I've always been interested in. In Henry IV, Part 1, there's a character named Toby who never appears. And several people have pointed out Shakespeare's success in delineating characters and says, and this character is summed up in one line. The Toby is not with these travelers. And someone asked about him, you know, he's not here. Poor Toby, he never joyed since the price of oats rose. I mean, that tells you that you know what that guy is like.
Right.
Just in that one line.
But, well, Shakespeare survives. You know, Shakespeare is good after Brooks and Warren. He was good before.
Yeah.
But other poets like Longfellow paid the price for Brooks and Warren coming in and looking. You know, my mother taught English, and she didn't ever go line by line and say, what does this line mean? What's the symbols here? But that's how I took English in college and in high school, too. I mean, we examined every line and made sure everything was tight and controlled and rich. You know, sort of the iceberg theory. A poem is like an iceberg. 10% shows, 90% is under the water.
You can't just tell the story flat out?
Not anymore. Oh, lift me from the grass. I die, faint, I fail.
Yeah.
You know, if I wouldn't have the nerve to write that to Margaret.
Well, it's what happened to the definition of poetry is a spontaneous overflow of powerful emotion.
There's a romantic speaking.
As a romantic, yeah.
Yeah, well.
And romance is gone.
It doesn't work as well.
Well, it's just gone. We are not a romantic people anymore.
No, one of the books that somebody recommended and will eventually get to recommending is a book suggesting the problem with civilization today is there's too much irony.
Yeah, well.
But good poetry almost has to contain irony. One of the greatest poems as a tribute to someone who has died is John Crowell Ransom's Bells for John Whiteside's Daughter. John Whiteside was John Crowell Ransom's neighbor in North Carolina or South Carolina, and the 12-year-old girl suddenly died. And John Crowell Ransom wrote a poem for to be read at her funeral. And the last, the poem begins, there was such speed in her little body and such lightness in her footfall. It is no wonder her brown study astonishes us all. And the last poem, there must be four stanzas. The last stanza is, but now go the bells and we are ready. In one house we are sternly stopped to say we are vexed at her brown study lying so primly propped. Huh. No grief, but real grief, because it's done by holding back, right? That is a great poem.
Yeah, you know, the old stuff is great, too. I think
I know, but we just have gotten out of the habit. You know, when I am dead, my dearest, sing no sad songs for me. We don't do that anymore, except in Hallmark cards. Well, we should. I know, but
yeah,
it's the form of criticism, the way we teach English now, it's just that John Crowell Ransom works better.
So you were an accomplice in ruining my life, huh? Because I'm a romantic stranded in modern times.
Well, that's not to... I mean, yeah, why do you like John Frederick Nims then?
Because that's a romantic...
He's a romantic under control.
Well, the fact is it is romantic.
So is... I mean, John Crowell Ransom is... There's real grief there for John Whiteside's daughter.
Uh-huh.
But it's more grief because it's so controlled and ironic and laid back.
Yeah. Poetry, I tell you, poetry is really something. It turns and twists, and it can reach in and twist your heart and your mind. You get the right poem, and it'll do its work. We're, Roel and I are just noodling today about poetry, and we will continue to do that because once we get on something like this, we cannot be stopped. But we will pause for a moment because we have Garrison Keillor to contend with.